Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela, and I'm very excited to have a guest with me today. Today, I have Professor Emma Hetherington. She is the Clinical Associate Professor and also Clinic Director of the Wilbanks Child Endangerment and Sexual Exploitation Clinic at the University of Georgia School of Law. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here to talk about this topic.
So let's just kick it off to talk a little bit first about, obviously the name of your clinic tells us a lot, but maybe tell us a little more about the focus of the clinic and the work that you're doing.
Sure. So for short, we call ourselves the CEASE Clinic. And what we do is we represent survivors of child sexual abuse, exploitation, and trafficking in a variety of proceedings that are essentially along the sexual abuse to prison pipeline. We represent survivors in juvenile court dependency proceedings, typically as the client-directed attorney. Occasionally, we will represent a child as guardian ad litem, but we prefer to represent children as the attorney. We also file civil lawsuits against perpetrators. We do that on behalf of survivors, whether they're currently children or as adults, for childhood victimization. And then lastly, we represent survivors in post-conviction relief matters where a survivor of trafficking has certain criminal convictions that were a direct result of their victimization or occurred while they were victimized. And we can go and either vacate certain convictions or in other instances, do record restrictions. So it's a lot, mostly on the civil side, of course. And we also, as a clinic at the University of Georgia School of Law, we also teach, we train, we have a partnership with the School of Social Work. We are a interdisciplinary practice. We have a full-time social worker on staff and three attorneys in our clinic. And we have 8 to 10 law students every semester that get to practice under Georgia's Law Student Practice Act. So they get to get their feet wet, get in court, learn dependency law, be in front of judges, all of that. And we also serve as a policy and research center. So we do a lot there, but it's all on behalf of survivors.
Yes, you guys sound very busy, and I know in your work you do get to talk to lots of attorneys and lots of survivors, you know, not only in the state of Georgia, but in other places. And I wonder if you could share with us your perspective on the biggest problems you see with the court system response to survivors.
There are a few things that we see as pretty major trends, not just here in Georgia, but in speaking with others across the country. Number one is not fully understanding what sex trafficking or trafficking in general is, those specific legal definitions and other definitions that we have. Identification is the number one issue. There's a lot of barriers to that. In terms of definition, we know, so a lot of times we'll mix our definitions together and we'll say human trafficking. Well, human trafficking is an umbrella term that covers all forms of trafficking, which would include sex and labor trafficking. Sometimes you'll hear people equate human trafficking to slavery. Human trafficking is not slavery. Slavery is a form of human trafficking, but it is not all human trafficking. You have to be very careful with that one. In terms of what we call CSEC here in Georgia, that's what we call it. Other states, you might hear it as CSET with a T, CSA with a Y, DMST or domestic minor sex trafficking, or just as CSE, commercially and sexually exploited children. And this is a range of crimes and activities that involve the sexual abuse or exploitation of a child for the financial benefit of any person or that's in the for the exchange of anything of value. So this could be money, it could be drugs, it could be a place to stay, it can be a meal. Something that is important to know also with CSEC is that there's not always a trafficker involved. If a child is under the age of 18, they cannot consent to be trafficked. That's federal law that's under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. A lot of children who are unsafe at home, maybe they've been abused and neglected, let's say that they've eloped or run away from their home or placement, may engage in survival sex. So they need a place to stay, they need a meal, things like that. So it's not just about an exchange for money. And it's also important to know that children cannot be prostitutes. So I think that is understanding the definition can get us a pretty long way in fixing some of that those identification issues that I definitely think is a huge one.
And that's come a long way since I got into this in terms of kids being charged for prostitution for underage youth, you know. So I do think we've made some progress in that way. But I guess what I'm thinking of is maybe people not in larger areas may not realize that you know, they see these kids coming in, you know, older youth coming into the dependency child welfare system, and they may not be identified this way. What would you recommend an attorney do in that situation if they are if they suspect that the child is falling in, you know, is a survivor? What steps do they need to take at that point?
Well, number one would be if you are representing a child aged 12 or older who is in care, I think that you should have some sort of a screening tool. And there's lots of checklists and screening tools that are out there to assess whether or not you think this child might be a victim or survivor of CSEC. There are not many that have been validated necessarily, and there are some that are really should be done by social workers or therapists or, you know, intake officers, people like that. But I'd be happy to provide a checklist that might be useful. But just things like you look at the client's file and it says, oh, they've run away. They've run away on several occasions. They're ungovernable. They're unruly. They have what we call here in Georgia, CHINs, or children in need of services. So not necessarily delinquencies, but also having delinquency charges. A number of delinquency charges might be there. If the child has been, you know, quote unquote, in the company of older men, it's not only men that are traffickers or abusers, but that's when I see a lot of they were found in the company of older men. They were found at a hotel. That's a big one too. So when you see those types of indicators, you should start thinking, okay, maybe this is it. They have more than one cell phone. That would be another one. That would definitely be another indicator. But we know that the average age of entry into sex trafficking is 12 to 14. And we also know that children in foster care are at a much greater risk of either already have been trafficked before they come into care, but also of being trafficked while in care. This is a major at-risk population. Children of all races, genders, sexual orientations can be trafficked. You know, I think we think of the movie Taken, and that's the classic example that we always like to give. It's what real trafficking is, what real CSEC is not the movie Taken. It is a child who is living in poverty, maybe doesn't have the parental support, maybe they've been abused and neglected. The statistics are kind of aren't completely solid, but around 70 to 90% of victims of sex trafficking were sexually abused when they were younger. So we know that these kids really can come from everywhere. And we see them a lot and disproportionately so in the child welfare legal system. And so if you are representing a child age 12 and up, you should be screening.
That's a good point. You know, and as you're talking, I'm thinking about the challenges we have in any of the cases, any of the dependency cases, in building trust with our clients. Maybe talk a little more about the unique challenges that come along with representing a child who is a survivor.
One thing that is important to keep in mind is that we know that survivors of CSEC are more likely to come from homes where they don't have a trusting, stable caregiver or person to love them, and that they want that though. If we do not give them trust and care and connection at home, then they are going to seek it elsewhere. That's just human nature. Often, children will form very strong bonds with buyer or with their traffickers, right? That is because that person has provided for them in a way that maybe their caregivers at home did not. They have no reason to trust the system. They have no reason to trust necessarily their family. And so that's a huge burden, is oftentimes that child's most connected person is their trafficker, that they're going to trust the most. And gaining their trust is very difficult. I think it's important to remember that they do not owe us their trust. at all. We have to earn their trust. I have to show them, I have to show up. I need to explain to them what is going on in their case. I need to engage them in coming up with solutions and options. I need to make sure that their voice is heard in court. I need to visit with them. I need to follow through. When I say I'm going to visit them, I'm going to visit them, not just visit them for 5 minutes before court. If I have a client that maybe did elope from a placement or from home and I know where they might be, I might go out there to see them. I might go bring them a meal, right? Now it's going to depend on your office and their policies and safety and all of those things. But if you just keep showing up, that's huge and build. It's with any kid, right? You just have to keep showing up and you have to follow through, but it might be more challenging to gain that trust with that particular client. Know that they may not always call you back. Know that they may not always text you back. They may not give you the information that they need, and that they are not going to necessarily thank you for anything that you're doing. And that's okay. They don't have to. And it doesn't mean you're not doing a good job. It just means that, you know, they have a long way to go before they are going to trust you or anyone in the system.
Yeah, that's very helpful. I think it's kind of next level to what you need to be doing with any client who's involved in the foster care system, and just another level of understanding and empathy for the situation and willingness to keep trying and keep showing up, like you said. One of the things that comes to mind as you talk about that is that this, you know, we as attorneys are operating within a whole system, and I think can often be seen as part of that system that, you know, that the youth is automatically going to push back against. What are some of the things that we can do and how we, not only how we relate to the child, but how we relate in court and with other professionals that is, that might help us build that trust and distinguish ourselves from the system that is trying to lock them up or, you know, do things that they do not want to do?
Sure. So every time I talk to one of my clients, unless it's a client, well, I always give an intro, no matter what stage of trust or relationship I'm in with a client. Obviously for new clients, give them my name. But for clients that don't know me very well, I'll quiz them and say, hey, do you remember my name? I always make sure they know my name, right? That's so important. I make sure that they have my number. I make sure they know what I do. And I quiz them on it to make sure they understand, okay, what's my job? What does that mean? What do I do? And of course, I've explained this up front multiple times, but eventually I start the quiz just to remind them, okay, we've talked about confidentiality before. Can you remind me what that means? And not in a condescending way, and not in, I think you're, I mean, my clients are brilliant. They're amazing. They survive things that most of us will never have to survive. And they are brilliant for it. They're smarter than all of us, honestly. Mm-hmm. They can run circles around us, and they should, because they've earned it, honestly. But when it comes to, you know, building that trust, building that relationship, explaining those things, that's important. And then when I say that things are confidential, that my clients tell me, I mean it. So for example, big issue that always comes up with this population is cell phones, right? Children live on their cell phones. Teenagers live on their cell phones. When we're talking about survivors of CSEC, we're mostly talking about kids, you know, like I said, 12 and up, 14 and up, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, they live on their phone. One, we need to be teaching them independent living skills. Independent living skills means that we learn how to use a phone safely and we have phones. I've had lots of clients that tell me that they have phones, and multiple throughout the years, 12 years of doing this, or much more recently now that everyone has phones, but that they tell me that they have phones, but they don't want me to tell the court because technically maybe they're not supposed to have a phone. I advise them legally what is and isn't allowed. And I say, okay, thanks for telling me. And then I don't say anything. And then later when it's found or something and someone else finds it and tells on them, they know that it wasn't me. I'm not the one that told it, and that I kept it. I kept it secret. That goes such a long way, such a long way. I'm on their side. I make sure that they know I'm on their side. Here's another little thing. Find out what their favorite snacks are. Find out, do they like to color? Do they like, kids love coloring of all ages. They have those, you know, more like adult, like really intricate, for example, coloring books. We bring those to court with us. We bring fidgets with us to court. We bring bottles of water for them. All of my clients love Takis. I know exactly what color of Takis they like. The blue ones, by the way, apparently the best.
Blue,
Yeah, I'll believe it. But yeah, I'll bring some Takis, I'll bring some water, I'll bring some fidgets, I'll bring some stuff for them to color, to do. I sit and I engage with them when they're waiting around for hearings. I sit with, if I can, and I'm not busy on other cases or running around too much, I make sure I'm with them. If I can't be with them, I check in on them often. I make sure that I'm transparent about where I am, why I'm doing it, et cetera, so they don't think I'm just ignoring them and I'm just part of that system. And I think really importantly, I don't take things personally. I can't even tell you how many times my clients have said to me, well, y'all are doing this to me and y'all are making me do XYZ. Very often my clients will say, Emma, you know, I don't mean you're not, you're, I just mean y'all. I don't mean you. I say, I
Yeah.
know. But even if they don't clarify, that's fine. Even if they
Okay.
do mix me in with everyone else, that's fine because I have to earn the trust for them to clarify that they don't mean me with the system. And until then, they have every they it makes sense that they would equate me with the system.
Well, and
So
it
I'm just
looks like,
another person at court.
yeah, it looks like, I mean, that was always when I first started, I was always floored by that. Like, it really does seem, particularly when you're in the kind of situation where you have one case after another, it's not like that everywhere, but you know, it's like the main players are still standing there, you know? And so we can look like we are just part of the machine. You know, as you were talking, the other thing that came into my mind, we're always focused on permanency and, you know, what is the focus of the representation? And I think there's always this tension among all the professionals between keeping them safe and, like you were saying, teaching them skills to survive out in the real world. And I think what I have seen at least is that the system defers toward lockdown safety, rather than how do we teach and work with this individual so that they don't fall right back into this when they turn 18. So I know you work with that every day. What are some thoughts you have around that?
We take a harm reduction approach in our office. And what harm reduction essentially means is that we are working to make the small steps to make a child safer. We can't make them the safest that they will ever be in a short period of time. You're going to set yourself and the child up for failure. It doesn't work that way, right? We need to think about, I think, as child attorneys, we go to a lot of CLEs about being trauma-informed. It's about implementing trauma-informed practice and also making sure that we truly understand what that means. So when I have a child who might be yelling, they're angry, they're avoiding things, they're being rude, quote unquote, et cetera. Those to me, those behaviors show me that that child is dysregulated, that something has triggered them, right? So you have a child who has, we know that they've experienced early adversity, toxic stress their whole lives. They've had cortisol rushing through their bodies at all times. Like I said, they're out there surviving. And so I might see a cat in the hallway, but they see a tiger. And that's valid. That's completely valid, their reactions to this. I do not need to react. You want to level your response to the child to the behavior, not at the child, if that makes sense. So the child is not manipulative. They're not defiant. That's not what they are. They're triggered. They are responding in a survival type way. It doesn't mean they're going to run away, right? It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that they can't be in a foster home. I think one of the things that drives me crazy sometimes is this idea of, oh, the child needs to earn a foster home. No, they don't. Per federal law, they need to be in the least restrictive placement and most family-like setting. And what we have seen, and now it's anecdotal, and I would love to do a study on this one day, but what we have seen is that when you put children in a foster home with fictive kin, with a family member that they trust, that they are connected to, and who allows them to be kids, sees them as kids, not as these sort of adultified, defiant, engaging in risky behavior, bad kids. When we look at them that way, you know, if we can reframe it, this is a child, right? This is a child who has seen trauma, who has been through trauma, and is giving us natural survival responses. And connect with them, show them you're going to keep showing up. They don't run, they stay put. They might test because, of course, they're going to test because they need to make sure you're safe. If a child does not feel safe, they are not safe. So here's what trafficking can look like. You're with a trafficker, you're staying at hotels. The trafficker tells you where you can be. The trafficker tells you what you can wear, whether or not you can have a cell phone, what you can eat, when you can eat, how your hair needs to be, how your nails need to look, right? All of those things. You know what that also sounds like? That sounds like a group home to me. In foster care, that is so triggering. Yeah. So you restrict that child like that. Of course they're going to run away. Of course they're going to get upset. Of course they are triggered. And I think that we are all very well-meaning and we think, no, we have to keep them safe. This is how we keep them safe. Locking them in a cage does not keep them safe. It puts them back right in the trauma and they're going to react that way. And something I think is really, really, really important too is to think, how can we make this child feel safe? Not me think that they are. How are they going to feel safe? What does that mean for this child? And to listen to them.
That's a really important shift I want to highlight because the difference between us feeling like they're safe and them feeling safe is that's not how people think, in the system. And I wonder when you're advocating, say, for a client who you think would, could go to a foster home or has fictive kin, say, who's willing to take them, what sort of arguments do you use to overcome? We can't protect this child in that home because a trafficker could just show up. What sort of arguments? I mean, you've said some of it, obviously, but are there any specific things that you've used that other attorneys might use to turn the tide, I guess, away from let's just lock them up, where we can keep an eye on them 24/7?
I would say the best tool possible, which I know is not always at everyone's disposal because of finances and time and all the things, but would be an expert witness. Have an expert come in there and testify about what it means for a child who's been trafficked to feel safe and what is in their best interest, right? So to have a therapeutic provider person, we have our social worker, like I mentioned, we have a licensed social worker in our office. We've had her qualified in court as an expert in social work, case management, trauma-informed practice, cultural responsiveness. We've had her qualified as an expert in child sex abuse and child sex trafficking and CSEC, right? So we really use that. We also got a person who really is an expert in all of those things in our office. And I know that not everyone has that. But vet the kids. Staff at group homes, vet, especially if they're in a more CSEC specific placement, vet their therapists. Not all therapists are trauma responsive. So know that and really vet them in terms of do I want to use this person as a witness? But I think using your expert witnesses is really helpful. I think also showing if you can look through the record and show times when your client had some stability. And bring out testimony and evidence in court that supports the idea. And I promise you'll find this. You're going to find when a child was safe and stable, when they felt safe and they were safe, stable, and they were not in a group home, right? Maybe it was a respite care provider. What was it about that? Talk to the client about it. What was it that made you feel safe there, right? What was that? Go talk to the person that they were with when they were stable. What was it that made them safe and stable? And bringing those things out in court and showing, look, this we have had this. Now, you may not always be able to find that sort of smoking gun, so to speak, but that's usually really helpful. You can also use the history of, okay, we've tried this group home. They ran away. We tried that group home. We ran away. We tried this lockdown facility. Guess what? They ran away. Kids can run away from lockdown facilities. Unless you're talking about detention center, maybe you can run away from those too. But if we're talking about more of a group home setting, right, congregate care setting that is, maximum watchful oversight, kids run from those too. So if a child doesn't feel safe, they're going to figure out a way to get out. Again, these kids are survivors.
Well, and I wonder too whether tying that to, we've just been doing the series on older youth and how permanency may look different than what we are, working on with the newborn. I wonder if tying placement in a foster home or with fictive kin to what we want for this child long term is ever useful in your arguments.
Absolutely. So one thing too that I also should have said is, what are we basing the assumption on that this child cannot be in a foster home, cannot be with this fictive kin caregiver? If we've never tried this, if we've never allowed this child to be in that setting, can we actually say that they're not safe there? Right? We can't. We absolutely can't, especially if we have people that, again, are going to be working on building that trust. In terms of permanency, too, I've had plenty of clients who have ended up with permanent guardianships with foster parents that they've very much connected with, they've stayed with after they've turned 18 years old, right? This is one of your best bets for permanency with this population. Another thing to think about is, what services are we offering and providing to the parents and caregivers that our kids were with when they came into care? So we all know, and I think that y'all talked about this in one of the previous podcasts on older youth, is that kids are going to go back to their families. They're going to turn 18 or whenever it is that they exit care, and they are going to go to their families. So we have to foster that relationship no matter what. Now, is it always going to end in them being reunified? Maybe not. But if that's the goal, if that's our case plan goals, are we actually making reasonable efforts to return this child? What is it that this child needs? That child did not feel safe at home. A lot of times it's, oh, the child's in care because of their behavior. Children are not in care because of their behavior. They are in care because they were abused or neglected. Their behaviors are symptoms of their trauma. And of course, their parents and caregivers don't know how to respond to it. Of course they don't, because they've also probably experienced that same trauma. So how can we strengthen the connection, the trust, right, between our clients and their parents and caregivers that they really do most often want to be with, so that they feel safe at home and can be protected at home? A regular sort of run-of-the-mill parenting class probably won't do it. One thing that we've been looking into a lot, that I've been working with the School of Social Work here at University of Georgia on studying and looking into all the research on, is trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI. It's out of Texas Christian University, the Garen Purvis Institute for Child Development. It is listed, their Caregiver 101 training is on the Title IV-E and California Clearinghouse as evidence-based. It's promising. They also have a grant right now that they recently got from the National Child Traumatic Stress Network to expand on that research. And they've implemented it in juvenile justice settings and courts, et cetera. But really, the core of it is the caregiver training. And that's the kind of thing that maybe we should start looking at, more interventions like that that go to the core of attachment between a child and their parent, and helping a child feel safe, and helping give parents the tools that they need to understand why their children might be behaving a certain way, and then for them to understand how their responses might exacerbate those behaviors, right? And where, and not in a blaming way, not in a blaming way, but in an understanding way, just to sort of help with the healing process.
And as I know, there'll probably be questions about it. Is that type of training, it sounds like it's could be ideal for whether it's a parent or fictive kin or even, certain foster parents. Is that something that can be accessed online, or do you need a certified provider in your area for that to be a possibility?
So, in order for someone to be considered a TBRI practitioner, there is actually a relatively robust process. However, anyone can learn it from most states. So, if you go to TCU's website, you can find lists of providers in your area or people that are TBRI practitioners. One thing that I like about it is that it's sort of a peer mentor model in a way. So, for example, in Shreveport, Louisiana, they have what are called, folks called, that are called TBRI advocates, and they are actually assigned to cases in court, and they work with the parent or with the caregiver and the child. They're not like a CASA, but they're sort of appointed in that way, and they've seen a lot of promise through that. I know that program's been implemented in a couple other states. I believe one was maybe implemented in Colorado recently. So if you don't have something like that, though, you can see who the practitioners are in your area. Also, they do have the TBRI 101 training online. There is an online version, but it works best when you have a practitioner or a mentor a TBRI mentor following that caregiver to help along, kind of like a parent aid, right? But it's something that, you know, there are many organizations that have been starting to implement this. Like I said, it's sort of like a growing thing. It started with adoptive parents, but there's a lot of interesting uses that we're doing some research into right now to see how we might be able to use it in other contexts within the child welfare system, particularly with birth parents, with families of origin.
That sounds really interesting. We'll include a link in case anyone's interested in the show notes so they can check out and see if there's anybody in their area that they could access for the family. We probably need to wrap up. There's one thing I've heard you say a number of times that I just want to make sure makes it into the episode, and it relates to taking away the survival strategies of youth. And I wonder if you might just talk about that for a minute before we wrap up.
Sure. So, like I mentioned before, a lot of the behaviors that we see in these kids that we, quite frankly, we criminalize those behaviors. Survivors of CSEC are more likely to be arrested, to be found delinquent, to be involved in CHINS cases than they are to actually receive victim or survivor-centered services. We are criminalizing them for their behaviors. Great. I'll also send you a link for the two great policy briefs out of Georgetown on the sexual abuse to prison pipeline, particularly as it applies to Black girls and how we criminalize those behaviors. One of the issues that we have that we see a lot of is that, like I said before, that those are survival responses. Those are survival strategies. These kids have had to survive out on the streets, at home, in foster placements, all these places where they've been abused, they've been neglected, they've been exploited. And one of the worst things that we can do is take away a survival strategy that they have and not replace it with another strategy that may be more appropriate. I have to credit Darren Jones from TCU for that one. I got that from him. But he's absolutely right. He always says, don't take away that baby's survival strategy if you're not giving him a new one to use. And I think that's absolutely true. They have survived because of this. This population of kids that have been victimized, you know, we don't want them to be in situations where they don't know how to respond. They don't know how to survive. And no, the survival strategies that they've used up to this point, we don't think that they're appropriate, but no one's taught them otherwise. No one's actually taught them otherwise. And instead of us approaching it as, okay, you know what? That's actually pretty smart what they're doing right now. There's always a function behind every single behavior. Kids don't just do things because they feel like it. Actual ODD, actual oppositional defiant disorder, is very rare. And yeah, we need to support, show them that we are supporting them, and we're not going to punish their behaviors that are symptoms of trauma. So please know that. Like, think about what are actual survival strategies. And it's really great to say, hey, you start to feel a little upset, go journal. That might not be the right survival strategy.
That's just such a good example of a well-meaning professional, but not responsive to the situation that the youth has been in. And I think probably a good way to wrap it up is, you know, as I heard you talking about that, we talk a lot about respecting the parents in these cases in order to be an effective advocate for the child. But I think having respect for the fact that the child has survived what they have, even again, if we would have hoped they would have found a different survival strategy. They have made it this far. And seeing that from a strengths-based lens rather than as they are doing these behaviors and like you said, either criminalizing them or even just talking about them in a way that is negative. And so I really think that's another shift in perspective that we can all look to make. So we could talk all day about this, and maybe we should come back and go into some more detail. But Professor Hetherington, thank you so much for being with us today. We really do appreciate
Yeah, of course. And I have to get one more thing in because it does
it.
relate, I promise. But
Go
the
ahead.
I wanted to say with survival strategies and but in particular with the behaviors that we see, I think what's important too is to really look at the core of what is the need that that behavior is speaking to. What is it? So I'm going to give one last example. I promise, just one last. Child's at a group home. The group home locks up the food. There's certain times they can eat, certain times and what they can eat, et cetera. They're hungry, they want a snack. Maybe they took some food out of the pantry at some point, hid it in their room. Now they're going to get in trouble for it. They start getting dysregulated. They start yelling back, right? They're getting all upset. They're throwing things across the room. What's the need? Maybe they had food insecurity, right? Maybe that's why. Maybe their blood sugar was low. Maybe they were hungry. Why should the food be locked up? You need to give kids opportunities to hear the word yes from you and that you are going to meet that need. That's a very simplified example. But the behaviors are screaming at you that they need something. Figure out what it is and find an appropriate way to meet that need and show that child that you are going to say, yes, I will meet your need. And they are much more likely to stick around. They're much more likely to be open to services and all the other things in the system. So, really, thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it.
That's an excellent example, and the fact that we still have so many placements locking up food is beyond me. But anyway, thank you so much for your time, and thanks everybody so much for listening. If you are enjoying the podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you'll know when our next episode comes out.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.